This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Chat with James King on Free FM. This is your weekly discussion program talking about national, local, national and international news. If you'd like to be part of the program, please just join me on jamesking2020@gmail.com. I'd love to have your comments, your questions, your queries, your criticisms, jamesking2020@gmail.com. On the program today, I talked to broadcaster and political commentator Paul Barlow about the National Act, New Zealand First Coalition's first budget. Some say it's a responsible budget, others say it's no frills, and National claims it's delivering on its promises. So how do we rate it? What's the state of play? And what does the budget mean for the government going forward? To talk about this and other things, I'm joined now by Paul Barlow. Good morning, Paul.
How are you going?
I'm going very well, and how are you?
Oh, yeah, very long weekend.
A very long weekend. I hope a good weekend.
Fantastic week, yeah. Lots of nerding out and doing Armageddon things.
Armageddon, yeah. Is that on, is it?
They've got their big winter exhibition on at the moment up here in Tamaki, so it's been very hectic the last few days.
Oh, very good, very good. By way of introduction, if people haven't heard of you and what you do, give us a brief summary of your what's led you to this point as a political commentator and broadcaster.
It's something I've done for a very long time. It's probably the easiest way to say I fell into it by accident. I used to write the stuff in the Waikato Times. I've done a whole bunch of stuff on Free FM over the years. Just sort of evolved into social media things these days. Sort of popping up everywhere.
That's right, and you're doing a very good job, it has to be said.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Now, down to business, the budget was out a couple of weeks ago, and what we make of the budget is, I guess, foremost on the mind as the dust settles after its publication, if you like. How do you rate Finance Minister Nicola Willis?
I think that this is going to go down in history as one of the most forgettable budgets we've ever had, to be honest. There was obviously no sort of treats given out, because there was never going to be under this government, because everything is terrible, apparently, and the world is falling to pieces and they can't afford to do anything. But I think the biggest snafu that they made was actually around the cancer drugs that they didn't fund, that they'd been promising. And Labour and the opposition parties in general have been taking them to town for it. Like it's a simple thing that the funding levels weren't overly huge that they could have actually organised, but then, you know, they gave their $2.9 billion back to landlords for their tax deductibility. They gave $4 billion to Simeon Brown to fix potholes. You know, that they could have taken $700,000 from that and, you know, made those drugs available to people.
The government, or at least National's promises, have been delivered on, according to them. That's tax relief for hard-working Kiwis, it's investing in frontline services and stopping wasteful government spending. Do you think that's big enough, those three are big enough issues for Kiwis to respond in a positive way to the National government?
I think there's actually a big difference between what they're saying they've delivered and what they are actually delivering. Because it's great buzzwords to say we're delivering for hardworking Kiwis.
Yeah.
But if you take a look at those tax cuts themselves, the regulatory impact statement, for example, that came out with the budget showed a much rosier picture than the reality, because it didn't incorporate that tax deductibility return to landlords.
Right.
And if you incorporate that, it actually meant that 65% of all the money that was given back in tax refunds, or tax relief, as they like to call it, went to the top 40% of earners in the country. Whereas there were about 3,000 people they estimated that would get the total benefits of all the tax packages, but IRD also estimated that there were 8,000 people who would actually be worse off under it. So in terms of it giving back to people, it doesn't really work. People on benefits don't get anything extra. People who are on incredibly low incomes or working part-time for minimum wage, they might be lucky to scrape together a couple of dollars a week. Senior citizens, people on pensions, they are lucky if they get $4 a week each. So like, there are some really hard-hit groups in that. Well, a lot of them are traditional right-wing voters as well. You know, senior citizens has been Winston Peters' bread and butter for the last 40-odd years.
Yeah.
But there's very little in there for that. In terms of cutting to the back room to help with the frontline services, I think that's also a bit of a sales pitch line. It sounds really good on paper.
Yeah.
But you try running a hospital without the people that can order stuff or organise times for people to have their operations or appointments or anything like that, it just doesn't work. And I think it didn't help that a couple of days after the budget, the police even turned around and said, yeah, it's nice that we've got the money there for frontline services, but we're getting rid of 200 people in the back office and that's going to clog everything up for us. So, yeah, it's not a great look that as much as they try and spin it, they're still getting feedback that it hasn't really hit the right place.
$226.1 million over 4 years to deliver 500 extra frontline police officers. As you say, you need those backroom staff, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we're losing so many police officers to Australia at the moment. They go from a five-figure to six-figure income over there. So
yes.
I totally get what the appeal is. There are news stories running in Aussie at the moment about the number of New Zealand cops that are joining their forces.
Right. So it's a thing.
A struggle for them to hit that 500 mark that they're aiming for.
$1.2 billion for regional infrastructure. That's got to be a good thing. That's a New Zealand First initiative. $65 million over 4 years to maintain the apprenticeship boost scheme.
Yes.
That's got to be a good thing.
And that's definitely not a bad thing. The infrastructure one's an interesting one because Shane Jones has always been a big fan of his regional infrastructure funds. National were really against it when it was Labor New Zealand First and Coalition.
Right.
So I suspect they fought really hard for this. And there were some questions about what counts for regional infrastructure because there was a few funding rounds last time that went to things like greyhound racing, which doesn't really count towards regional infrastructure for a large group of people. But if they can invest it in a way that's going to help people, then it's definitely not a bad way to spend that money.
$1.7 billion funding boost for PharmAct to ensure continued access to the medicines Kiwis rely on. That's another, apparently, initiative that New Zealand First has prioritised.
So that was an interesting one as well, because PharmAct turned around and said, yeah, like it's a bit of a boost. It was only about $500 million more than what Labor had planned to give them if they'd been re-elected.
Yeah.
So it's essentially enough to keep the lights on and keep them doing their job. It's not enough to fund new drugs.
One of the interesting things out of the budget, and it was talked about at length before the election and, in fact, during the election campaign, and that's this $69 million to reduce or address serious youth offending, including the military-style academy pilot, which is another word for boot camp. How do you... what do you think of that?
It's really kind of funny when you look at the evidence for it, because it's never worked here. It's never worked anywhere that it's run. All of the academic evidence says it doesn't work. And that's because the only way that any kind of education system works, whether that's a boot camp or a charter school or anything like that, is if those involved with it, the students who take part in it, want to be there and feel they're getting something out of it. If you force a student or a child into something like this, they're going to start resenting authority figures. They're going to be faster, smarter criminals. And that's what all of the academic research says. And the only sort of pushback that the government has given to that has been, but we're going to do it differently. But they haven't given much in the way of details on what different means. This government is very much about punitive responses as opposed to getting to the source of the problem. And so, you know, it's bigger prisons. Tougher on crime, but it doesn't actually deal with the issues of what's causing crime.
Which
the biggest driver for crime is poverty.
Poverty, you know?
Poverty is the biggest part.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the police are sort of the rock and the hard place type situation.
The police can't comment on certain things, which makes sense because, you know, they're the police, they have to remain impartial to a lot of this. I can't imagine that they are enjoying their time at the moment. You know, they've been told you've got to be tougher on gangs and you know, go and break up anywhere that they're wearing gang patches sort of thing. And at the same time, that's not stopping crime from happening. That's just about making people feel better.
Yeah.
So it's a really strange thing to see how the cops have sort of been stuck between a rock and a hard place on this one.
It's the law and order government, isn't it? Because they've also put $803 million to respond to the increase in the prison population. I don't know what that means exactly, whether that means that they're going to build more prisons or accommodate more beds in prisons, in the existing prisons we have. But there's $803 million.
They've already made announcements about increasing Waikeria
and
upping the level of bed numbers that are there. And that they're constantly looking at increasing the amount of prison numbers that are out there. But also because they decided to be a little bit more punitive in the way that they deal with crime, they're expecting an increase in numbers as well.
Do you look at this budget and say that in many respects it indicates a punitive aspect that we haven't seen before?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one for the fact that it's our first budget with a three-headed coalition. So there's a little bit of everything in there. I suspect if it had been driven primarily by National, for example, it wouldn't be quite as extreme in some areas because New Zealand First and ACT have their extremes.
Yeah.
It is quite an interesting one for that respect. It'll be a lesson for future governments.
It's the New Zealand First Party says it's all about practical solutions rather than ideologies. They say they're bringing back common sense and balance to the government. And they're rebuilding our country for many, not the few. What do you make of that?
So that would be much easier to take at face value if they hadn't turned around and said things like, "We're going to do a bathroom bill that bans transgender people," or Shane Jones, just I think yesterday or the day before, put out a tweet about how oil and gas exploration and mining is back because it's not woke. So they sit there and they say it's not about ideology and then use ideological lines to push what it is that they want to get across. And that very much speaks to their current voter base, which are people who are driven by things like conspiracy theories and disinformation and who think that the word woke is some kind of insult. They're very good at ideological pushes. And then they can turn around and say things like, mining's great for the economy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the reason that they're doing it. There's also a lot of stuff that, like the smoking laws, for example, that the softening on taxes for that, that's very much an ideological thing, not necessarily an economic driver. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there that they're really good at saying, yeah, this is for the economy, and it's clearly not.
So the budget and the budget cuts, where are they to be found? I suppose in terms of redundancies for government jobs.
You're looking at just about 7,000 people without work at the moment who have been made redundant from the public sector.
Yeah.
So that's likely to increase as well. But again, this is where we don't really necessarily know who's been made redundant and why. We've just been told, you know, lots of public servants is bad. And there's no justification why it's bad.
No.
We need to make the number lower. So we do know some areas that have been hit in strange ways, like the suicide prevention office. You know, there was that sort of furor that came out a few months ago where it's like, we're shutting this down because we've been told to cut budgets. And that obviously got people upset and they sort of mobilised a bit about that. So the government said, no, we're saving it, don't worry. But the way that they've saved it is that Te Whatu Ora, the Ministry of Health, is no longer having anybody actually employed in there. They're just going to have people pulled from other jobs to work in there a few days, a few hours a week, which means that you don't have a dedicated, even individual, whose job it is to make sure that that office is doing what it needs to do or reaching the people it needs to reach. So I suspect the idea of, you know, blanket cuts is one of those things that sounds really positive and that you're saving a whole bunch of money. But we will see in the next 12 to 18 months just how bad that can be.
The government says it's found $5.9 billion a year of savings and revenue initiatives. Whilst that sounds like a lot of money, is it really?
Not really. $5.9 billion sounds like a big number, but you know, $2.9 billion for tax deductibility for landlords takes up a large chunk of that. It was something like $6 billion for the ferries, I think, that we're looking at, for the ferries and the infrastructure and all that kind of stuff.
So yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot. It sounds big, because not everybody is dealing with billions on a day-to-day basis. But
no.
In terms of government spending, not really.
At least for $1.48 billion to build new schools, upgrading the existing ones, $448 million for a continued healthy school lunches program. Now, this was something that they were dead set against.
Yeah, this is also a really interesting one, because ACT worked really hard to do the whole, this is, school lunches are a waste of money. You know, it's not the school's responsibility. We're one of the only developed countries up until a few years ago that didn't have some kind of school lunch program. And then after they turned around and said, we've saved school lunch, we don't know who we saved school lunches from, who was threatening them, but, you know, we saved them.
Yeah.
Which was really odd. The school infrastructure one's actually really interesting as well, because that ties in to an area like FICAHA, the Ministry of Disabled Peoples, where we saw them suddenly run out of money and tell people in that community, no, you can't have anything else, so just step back. Part of those infrastructure upgrades is to ensure access for people with disabilities. So that means things like ramps being built and steps being evened out and stuff like that, which, you know, definitely not a bad thing to invest in and to make sure is available for people. But that doesn't necessarily mean that your air conditioning in schools, for example, are being upgraded in a time when we've got massive issues with respiratory viruses. It doesn't mean that your buildings are being earthquake-proofed, or also saying this is a win for disabled people and look how much we're investing in the school, but they're not giving enough money to do both.
So why is that?
Because it sounds really good in the press, but it doesn't look great on paper and nobody reads the paper. They just look at what's in the news.
What's in the news, yeah. $651 million over 4 years, as I say, to increase the COP numbers, but nothing in terms of whether they're going to do anything proactively about paying conditions for police.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that I noticed come out before the election, before the budget, was a warning that that number is likely to change because those negotiations are still ongoing, and they sort of have to build a budget around what it might be, but they don't know the outcome. So that's one that, you know, it would be ideal for them to stay within the numbers, but it's not likely to happen. Because, you know, cops are after a pay rise, but in mediation at the moment,
yeah.
They couldn't come to an agreement. So that will be a number that changes, I think.
It'll probably change to, it'll probably be increased, won't it? Because the government won't want to have the police dragging out paying conditions, especially when so many police are going overseas.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they want to stop that flow from going overseas, and the only way to do that is to make sure that people are compensated fairly.
What's wrong with working couples each receiving $55,000 a year, at least $100 per fortnight back in their hand?
How do they get that money back?
Through tax relief.
So it depends on what they're actually eligible for, because tax relief is a really tricky one.
Right.
A lot of the tax relief that they're talking about, things like ECE refunds, which you have to manually do every fortnight through IRD. In terms of where that money goes, though, tax relief is one thing. You were giving you this money, but we're going to charge you more for your registration on your car.
Right.
Fuel prices are going to go up. Public transport goes up. School costs go up. So it is a bit of a sleight of hand trick. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure that there will be people out there who, you know, they might be in the right income bracket, they don't have any issue with the slight increase in cost of schooling or public transport or whatever. There will be some people who benefit from it, but it is, any tax cut is a sleight of hand trick if it comes at increasing cost for public service.
And, of course, borrowing money as well.
Yeah, that was the other interesting one about this. I thought the funniest response I saw to the budget was actually the taxpayer union, who criticised how much money had been borrowed in this one. National borrowed, I think it was about $10 billion.
Yeah, it was 10 or 12, yeah.
Was it 12? And then their tax refund package was about $14 to $15 billion worth.
Yeah.
But they're not borrowing for taxes, they're borrowing for operational costs, which is an accountant's way of saying we're moving the numbers around a little bit so we're not borrowing for tax cuts.
It's a bit of shifty, isn't it?
It is. Oh, absolutely. Liz Truss tried it in the UK, and it did not work out for her at all. And you know, we've already had a warning from a couple of international ratings groups like Fitch's, who have said we're really concerned about this. You know, it's not a good look. And the taxpayer union were really upset because this government borrowed more than five of the six Labor budgets borrowed, and they were not impressed.
So to the, why do they need to borrow money if they're cutting so much out of wasteful spending of the government?
Because they want to deliver tax cuts.
How much are we talking about in terms of tax cuts? I forget.
So I think total tax cut package worked out $12 billion.
Yes, I think you're right. Yeah.
And that's a lot of money. And don't get me wrong, people love the idea of tax cuts. They sound very appealing. And we haven't had a tax cut in 14 years. So it's a really long time. But there, you have to pick and choose your times for it. And if we're seeing such a huge economic downturn, you know, maybe hold off those tax cuts a few months, like Treasury suggested, waiting until October for them, or 12 months, because then you've got a chance to find your footing, get everything sort of equalised and how your spending's going out, and then look at what you can save. But nope, they promised tax cuts and Nicola Willis didn't want to quit.
And they claim they are the responsible, what do they say, delivering on the promises they promised for hardworking Kiwis, you know. I just wonder if at the very bottom they have made a serious omission in terms of support and help for people at the bottom. You know, I'm thinking of people on minimum wage, although they've increased the minimum wage, I take it.
Kind of. The increase in minimum wage was more of a, in real terms, it's actually a step backwards because it's less than the rate of inflation. And because inflation's a driver in costs and the cost of living, by not having a pay increase that matches that, you're essentially losing the amount of buying power that you've got. And because it was such, it was the smallest minimum wage increase I think we've ever seen, because it was so far below the rate of inflation, essentially people who are earning minimum wage have lost that buying power that they had or that they were getting under those minimum wage increases under the previous government.
Do you think the government is taking the cost of living seriously enough?
No, not by a long shot.
Explain yourself.
It's a really convenient excuse to go, we're focusing on the cost of living. But if you look at what the actions were of this government under urgency in its first 100 days, almost nothing dealt with the cost of living. You know, it was things like stopping the IRD report into the unfairness of the tax system, or allowing the fast track bill to go through for mining and roading and stuff like that, and getting rid of Maori place names. You know, there was very little that actually focused on the cost of living, and every time they've gone about and said we're helping people with that, they've given with one hand and taken with the other. So for something like the regional fuel tax in Auckland, we're getting rid of the regional fuel tax. That's 11 cents a litre that people are paying. But we're also getting rid of the subsidy for public transport. So for kids who are going to school, that's an increase, depending on how far they're travelling, it's an average about $3 a day, or $3 a trip. So that's $6 a day, 6 times 5. That's how much extra you're paying on your bus trip all of a sudden to get your kids to school. Mm. So, yeah, you might be saving on petrol, but you're using a lot more of it. So it's a very much a sleight of hand shell game.
It's a case of take with one hand, give with the other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much. But only telling you that they're giving with the other.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. How do you think voters are feeling about the budget? And
it's actually a really interesting one because there's always post-budget polls, and traditionally there's been a post-budget bump in the polls. The first one that we saw come out, in fact, the only one we've seen come out so far since the budget, was the Taxpayer Union Curia poll. And that poll is always interesting anyway because it tends to lean much more right than the other polls.
Right.
And that saw a drop from the last Curia poll to the current Curia poll for the government, and it saw a massive tanking in the popularity of Christopher Luxon. But if you take a look at all of the polls that have been run so far this year, it was actually a slight increase for all of the parties that were involved in Parliament by about half a percentage point.
Right.
So I think people are kind of nonplussed by it. You know, that's why I think it's one of the most forgettable budgets that we'll have in a really long time. You know, give it 12 months time and we will have had the impact of how bad everything is economically really set in for people. But we'll also have things like inflation down to within the levels that it's supposed to be in, that we expect to be in. So that'll have a bit of an impact as well. And who knows what will happen on the international stage between now and then. You know, there's the US election, which will have a massive impact on things as well. So there's all sorts of factors that we should be aware of. But yeah, I don't think this budget's going to be the thing that saves this government or
history. Well, National is down 1.9% on last month to 35.4, while National is also, at least Labor is also down marginally on 29.4%, a slight decrease of 0.6%. But the Greens remain in third place with 2.5 points on last month to 12.7. They're doing very well at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, the Greens are actually holding really steady. And if you take a look at the average of all of the polls that we've had so far, the Greens are sitting on about 12.6% of the party vote, whereas New Zealand First is sitting on just on five. So, you know, there is some interesting stuff that's going on there. But if you take a look at something like the Curia poll from May, National's on 37.3, now they're on 35.4. But if you compare that to the Talbot Mills poll that was done a week later, National was on 33. The Talbot Mills poll a week before, the National was on 34. So they tend to lean right in the polling for Curia.
Right.
And that always, and I'm sure it's a complete coincidence that the head of the board members of the Taxpayer Union are also founding members of the ACT Party, the ACT Party always overperforms in the Curia poll compared to everything else.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. So, like the current poll, for example, for ACT has them at 9.7 under the Curia poll. The Talbot Mills poll has them 7%. Kantar has them 7%. It's only ever the Curia poll that seems to have them up higher than 7%. Mm. It's quite a substantial difference.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? The
how polling works.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Is this a budget of cuts or is it a budget of investment? How would you characterise it?
I think it's a budget of trying to make sure everything ticks over. I don't know. I don't think it's a budget of investment. They don't have the money to go and invest in all sorts of fancy things, so there was no sort of treats to it. But cuts, I think, are going to be what people remember most about it. There were little cuts in almost every part of it, and there are sections that most people don't pay attention to. Like Archives New Zealand, for example, that had a massive budget cut, which meant that the people doing genealogy research, for example, they no longer have access to a whole bunch of digital files, and files aren't being digitised. So if they want to do family history research, for example, they would have to go to Archives and dig out all of that paperwork. Places like the Film Commission got a cut, Creative NZ got a slight cut. There's lots of little slashes that made up this budget. And overall, that means that there's nothing that's seen as a really big winner or loser in it, which means overall people don't see it as being a problem.
So the free breast screening has got a funding boost of $31.2 million. That's got to be a good thing.
It is, absolutely. And National actually has campaigned for a little while on things like making sure that plan is extended, increasing the age of people who are eligible for it. Those are definitely good things. I absolutely applaud them for being able to do that. And I know that they launched, I think it was just before the election, it was like a mobile breast screening sort of bus service. And I think that's absolutely 110% behind it. I think that's definitely a valid thing for them to do.
There doesn't seem to be very much, though, in terms of men's health, prostate screening or things like that.
No. That's long been an issue. That men's attitude towards their own health has never been the greatest, and it takes a lot of work to change. It's almost like the definition of men being stubborn. You know, it takes such a lot of work to change our attitude towards things.
Yeah.
And men's health is huge. Like, we're actually at the tail end of Men's Health Week at the moment, so it's one of those areas that is definitely needing some work on. But it's also a really hard one to work out where to put the funding. Like, it would be great to get more money in there for prostate screening and stuff like that, but if men aren't going to do it, what's the point of putting the funding there? So we have to have some kind of plan of action to encourage people to do it, to make sure people are getting out there and looking after themselves. And to do that, you need money for backroom workers, you need money for contractors, you need money for people who are coming in and doing all the expert work on a case-by-case basis that this government has decided not to fund.
The government, this was an interesting one, I thought. The government is putting another $408 million into upgrading defence equipment and infrastructure. I wonder why the military, why the defence are getting this funding boost when they're, you know, arguably not doing as much on the international stage as in terms of relationships with Australia and the United States and what have you. I wondered if it was because of AUKUS and that kind of thing. What do you make of the $400 million increase in defence spending?
I think AUKUS may be a part of it. I mean, we keep hearing back and forth they haven't decided, they don't really know what's going on, and that certainly makes sense. Like, there are experts out there who don't know what's going on with it, and it keeps changing. Yeah. But there were, like, we've got an ageing military infrastructure. It's something that definitely needs to be looked at. A lot of what we actually saw last year with Cyclone Gabrielle, for example, and the work that the military did in helping that really highlighted the age and issues around some of our hardware and equipment that our military use. It might not be for military purposes, but our military is mostly peacekeeping and rescue recovery work. So that definitely is a part of it. The wages and salaries for people in the military have been pretty low for a while, so that's also a massive part of it. And there's also technical infrastructure coming in. We're doing a huge upgrade at the moment on things like our digital storage capacities, and so that involves quite a bit of funding that needs to go through just to make sure that, you know, we're up to date. We don't want to be running, you know, McAfee antivirus software for our military grade information and, you know, all of our state secrets that way. So I suspect that that's where the funding comes from. But we also know that Judith Collins, who's that minister, loves the military. Like, she's a big fan of the military.
Right.
And so it's not that much of a surprise to see an increase there, because she would have been quite vocal about that.
Just staying with the military for a minute or two, do you think that's ideologically driven, the support for the military?
I think so, in part. I mean, a lot of people, when you say military, automatically think of wars and violence and stuff like that. Realistically speaking, our military doesn't get involved in a huge amount of conflicts. There are some that seem problematic to people. Like our Navy, for example, is being involved in a training exercise in Hawaii with the Israeli government. And clearly what's happening in Israel at the moment is an area a number of people are passionate about and aren't particularly happy with us being involved in. So that kind of thing does pop up from time to time, but most times our military are there to help people who need to be helped. And so I think an attitude thing, like we see American military and go, oh yeah, that must be what our military does, and it's not that at all.
Right. There is a strong civil defence aspect to our defence force, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there has been since, you know, the Napier earthquake in the 30s. The first response has always been to send out one of the ships and to see what you can do to help. It was the same thing with Gabriel last year. One of the things that was really interesting, actually, about Gabriel was that we saw a really close working relationship with a number of other militaries around the world. We had people come in from the States, from Aussie, from some of the islands to help coordinate with that cleanup. Like, it was absolutely massive. And it's a great learning experience for our military to see how other military organizations work when it comes to how you help people. What's the best way that you can help people and coordinate those kind of efforts? And it's an area I think that more New Zealanders need to be aware our military is involved in.
The Labour Party put out a release the other day talking about what people that they've been talking to feel about the government's budget. Some of the comments here: I'd rather the money went to prescriptions, kids' lunches or health, anything but pointless token tax cuts for that we pay for, being one comment. On health becoming less accessible, we'll be getting tax back each fortnight, but we won't see it as it will now pay for my family's medical prescriptions. So, you know, there are, people are saying, aren't they, giving with one hand, taking with the other.
Oh, yeah. And the prescription thing is actually another fascinating one. The Treasury Department has been saying for years that prescription costs should actually be $10, not $5. So it's a good thing that it's not up to $10 because that's really prohibitive for a lot of people. And that they've got carve-outs in here, so, you know, senior citizens, people on with community services cards, they still don't have to pay as it's everybody else. But at the same time, the promise that was made was that those prescription fees would pay for those cancer meds that the government didn't fund. And so we've got the fees, we don't have the cancer meds.
Yes, and the and that's the problem, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and like every budget you have to reprioritise, and when you're juggling three coalition partners, you have to reprioritise things. Totally get that. But when it comes to promising something life-saving to people and how you're going to pay for it, you should work your ass off to make sure that's what happens.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. The while I've got you, just going back to the Greens for a minute, we have Chloe Swarbrick, of course, who's risen through the ranks and now has the exalted position of leader, co-leader of the party. What do you make of her?
She's a really interesting one in that I don't think you'll find somebody who is more divisive to right-wing fans than she is. They just don't like it. It doesn't matter what she says or what her arguments are. It's a very much pointed dislike of Chloe in general. And we haven't seen that since Jacinda.
Yeah.
So it'll be really interesting to see how she evolves with that. And I suspect Chloe is well aware of that as well. But I also know that for a younger generation, she is very much the poster child of politics and what you can do in politics and what you can achieve and what a young person can achieve. But she also represents a number of communities that we don't often see elevated to that leadership position. You know, she's part of the rainbow community, she's neurodiverse. So there's a number of sort of elements that younger people see in her that they don't see in older politicians, which I think is going to make her very successful in future elections.
In fact, she is more like the sole leader of the party than the co-leader of the party, isn't she?
And it's kind of a difficult one because Marama is, you know, very much policy-based and policy-focused, and she has a strong element around Te Reo Māori and Te Ao Māori. So I suspect that they work really well in partnership, but it's so fresh and new for Chloe to be in charge that there's also a lot of focus on her in that particular position. But I don't think the Greens are going to change their policy of having two co-leaders anytime soon just to make sure that one is exalted above the other.
Why does the Green Party have a co-leadership type approach?
So it's always been to make sure that there wasn't one person who was dictating everything. It's, I think, very similar for Te Pāti Māori. They tend to have a co-leader approach as well for that same reason. It's just to make sure that you've got that diversity of voices and that the people that are presenting and basically being the face of the party. The change that the Greens made last year was an interesting one because it used to be one man, one woman for co-leaders, and now it has to be one woman, one person of colour, for example. So, yeah, it's a very interesting sort of way of laying things out. They want to be progressive, and they're kind of forcing it into the party with those changes around their leadership rules. But I think their party in particular is very open to those changes. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they go over the next 12 months because they had a hell of a bad start to the year.
Yes, they did. But the Greens are a solid third-placed party. Do you ever see a possibility that it might go even further into being a major or the major party rather than Labour?
I suspect it could happen. It's a really tricky one because the Greens, you know, this is their best turnout ever in terms of parliamentary representation. But they keep going up and up. If it happens, though, I don't think it's going to happen any time in the next sort of 10 years. But again, that also depends on, you know, if we have a government that keeps attacking woke people because of mining or whatever, and focusing against the environment, that gives the Greens more fodder to go out and use their base and their skill set to increase their voter turnout. So I suspect if Labour's in charge and they're in the coalition, the Greens might suffer a little bit, which seems to happen to any kind of sort of support partners to a coalition government. So, yeah, it's a really tricky one to tell. If this government gets its way, though, and, you know, fast-track bills go through, the Greens will probably see a massive increase in support.
Who's voting for the Greens?
that's also a really tricky one to tell these days. They do have a much younger voter skew. If you look at maps of electorates, for example, areas around universities and tertiary institutions seem to have a much higher green voter turnout than they have a Labour turnout. But I think also when you're looking at a time frame where we're seeing the results of climate change now, we're seeing how it impacts people's lives. We've seen issues in the last 12 months around flooding and cyclones and some stuff like that. That makes people look at them and go, oh, yeah, what can you do for me? But I think having somebody like James Shaw, who was in there, who was much more business-focused, I think that sort of got people feeling a little bit like, you know, the Greens are actually looking at this from a range of perspectives, not just about not killing the lizards or saving the frogs.
Yeah.
So I suspect they had a bit of a base around there. But also there are a number of people who feel like climate action isn't an issue that's been taken seriously by the large parties in the way that they would like it to be.
Right.
And I think that those are the people that tend to be driven to the Greens.
And the Greens going forward, what do they need to do to maintain or even improve their position, do you think?
No more scandals would be a good start.
Yeah.
I think they've used up their quota of scandals for the parliamentary term. They have to come across as decisive. And that's actually where Chloe's communication skills come in really handy. She can come across as decisive, but people who adhere to a very right-wing ideology don't hear it. Like, all they hear is garbled noises, and it sounds like the teacher from Peanuts going, wah, 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 and they refuse to listen. So she's never going to make an impact there. But I think the Greens in general, if they hold on to those messages, if they highlight the issues that keep propping up with the current government sort of rushed to mine everything and take advantage of the environment, that's how they're going to make impact and inroads for the next election.
They have changed, haven't they, the Greens, over the last, 20-odd years?
Yeah.
Since the days of Nandor Tanchos, for example, to where we are today, the Greens is an entirely different party.
Oh, it is. Actually, I was talking to Gareth Hughes the other day, and Gareth is a fascinating one in that, you know, he was a Green MP himself for a decade. And he's actually left the Greens now to focus on other things. But one of the things he did after he got out of Parliament was wrote a book about Jeanette Fitzsimmons and her impact on the Green movement and how sort of her perspective came in and in a way has been sort of changed a little bit. And I thought that's kind of an interesting thing to look at. You know, you look at different generations of what the Green Party presents and it's different for each generation. And I suppose that's what you want. You want a party that can evolve a little bit. You know, if you look at what ACT is offering now to what they offered a decade ago, it's almost exactly the same thing.
Right.
So that evolution is not a bad thing for a political party.
The New Zealand First is committed to doing the hard yards to fix our broken country. Along with our coalition partners, we're committed to restoring law and order, easing cost of living, and providing better public health and education infrastructure to Kiwis. How do you respond to that?
Those are very nice words. I wish their actions matched it.
Right.
Because they really don't at the moment. The New Zealand First has always done the very good spin lines, but this iteration of New Zealand First is really concerning for a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of culture war stuff that's been bought in, you know, things about being woke are bad, that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah.
But the policy points that we've seen make waves for New Zealand First. They include things like, you know, bathroom bans and funding for amateur sports groups being cancelled if they don't deal with trans people, or making English an official language that doesn't need to be done.
Hmm.
You know, there's a whole bunch of that kind of stuff that it appeals to a certain subset of society. And then you've got issues around some of the MPs, for example, are just full-blown conspiracy theorists who hit it not particularly well. And so
right.
Now you've got them giving justification to organisations like Reality Check Radio, for example, or New Zealand doctors speaking out without science or whatever it is. You know, they're accepting them into Parliament, they're legitimising what they do and their viewpoints, which are dangerous viewpoints. And at the same time, you know, we're getting claims from them that they're going to end all mandates because that's what needs to be done for our economy. We don't have any mandates around vaccines for anybody outside of the health sector at the moment. And you'd expect the health sector to have mandates on how to keep people safe. There's a lot of of noise that's being made to talk to a certain audience. That is a very small audience, but it's not letting them focus on those actual issues that they claim that they're working on. That's the work that's been done by National and ACT and New Zealand versus just kind of riding their coattails for it.
Tagging along.
Oh, yeah.
The government has had, what now, how many months in power?
Eight months now.
How do you rate their first foray into government?
I am genuinely surprised that there hasn't been a snap election.
Really? Truly?
No. I would be surprised if we don't have an early election, but that's only because at the moment Winston gets whatever he wants and David gets whatever he wants, so everybody's all hunky-dory and happy.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes, there are a few people who are upset within the National Party because they feel they're being forced much more to the right by the coalition partners. I've heard of a couple of MPs that are looking at maybe jumping ship if David doesn't sort of cool down his heels a little bit when it comes to his anti-Māori rhetoric, which would be, it would be interesting to see it happen. But realistically, I think the time that we see an issue crop up is going to be when it's time to hand over the reins to David as Deputy Prime Minister.
True.
Or when the Treaty Principles Bill goes up for reading.
Do we know when that happens?
I believe it's supposed to happen before the end of the year.
Right.
The first draft is supposed to be introduced before the end of the year. But David's apparently thrown a few tantrums around the cabinet table of, I want this, and if I don't get it, I'm walking. That's his cornerstone policy piece. That was what held up the negotiations within the coalition at the start.
Yep.
He could do that again quite easily. And that's when I think you start to see the real cracks start to show. But for the last few months, credit where it's due, there's been very few cracks that have publicly shown between the three coalition partners. And the government has, on the whole, gone and done what they said they're going to do. It might not necessarily be popular or have benefits for the majority of the population, but they have done what they said they were going to do.
Going back to the Taxpayers Union poll, were you surprised by the poll, or did you think, that's pretty much the way you saw it anyway?
It's pretty much how I saw it. The thing that actually did surprise me about the Taxpayers Union, the week before last, Parliament wasn't sitting, but they had select committees on. And one of the select committees that they were running was around the removal of Māori wards bill, and the Taxpayers Union presented to that. And their presentation was, it was very typical for the Taxpayers Union, cost of money, and this isn't real democracy, and all that kind of crap. But the one that really got me was that they turned around and said, we're currently in the middle of our polling period, and it was this poll that's just been released.
Yeah.
And we're asking people what they think about Māori wards, and we suggest you listen. So it automatically implies that they know what the outcomes are going to be of the people that they're polling. And that's what I think is really interesting about the Curia poll. It feels like they kind of gave away the fact that there is a little bit of a bias to what it is that their polls say, and it always has been.
Right.
The overall result didn't surprise me that much.
It must be the same poll that I was looking at the other day that was put out on June 11. Is it the same poll?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realise that the Taxpayers Union was a right-wing government. A right-wing institution.
Oh, yeah. They're what we call an astroturfing group, and they're designed to look like a grassroots organisation, but they're actually really heavily funded by alternate sources. So the Taxpayers Union has really tight links to tobacco, to petrol companies, to mining, to a whole bunch of those sort of what seem like kind of destructive organisations.
Yeah.
That seems to be where they get their funding from. They're actually used quite a bit by the Atlas Foundation as well as look how much influence we can have in other countries kind of model. So anything that the Taxpayers Union comes out should always be taken with a grain of salt. Because they are incredibly biased in what they're doing. There are a number of institutes around the country like that that are set up as think tanks or as lobby groups where their influence is actually a lot more nefarious than people realise.
You're talking about organisations like Maxim and Muriel Newman's Institute.
NZCPR is a big one. the Taxpayers Union, the Free Speech Union are big ones. Pretty much anything that supports ACT, oddly enough, tends to fall into that category, which is a little bit concerning.
Well, it means that ACT punches above its weight even in a non-election, politically driven approach. It's got a lot of allies out there in the community.
I think it's more that it's got a lot of allies with a lot of resources.
Right.
If you have a look at what their overall sort of vote turnout was at the election, they got 9% last year. That's not quite 9%. You know, that's not a huge percentage of the population.
Yeah.
But the amount of influence they have now is well beyond that.
It's incredible.
You see that in the policies that are coming through. And that's because they're really well resourced. They were one of the highest earning parties in terms of fundraising during the election campaign period. So
did they get any funding?
Money getting behind them.
Did they get any funding from the tobacco industry?
I actually couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I don't know if they got anything directly. But I do know that there are links between some members of some parties and the tobacco industry. Casey Costello, for example, she was a spokesperson for the tobacco industry. So was Chris Bishop, actually. He worked for the tobacco industry for ages. So there are links there, but I don't know if there was any direct funding.
Do you think the government's taking the cost of living seriously enough? This is a question I've got through the email.
I don't think they have. I think they have. But realistically speaking, you know, if you're going out and you're buying a bottle of milk or you're going to the supermarket, how much extra is it costing you? How much is that fuel costing you when you go to places? Or if you're taking the bus or a train, how much extra is that costing you? But you're getting a few extra dollars in your hand for a tax cut. So I don't think that they've looked at everything that's causing issues with people and gone, right, how do we help make everybody's lives better? They've gone, we'll give you a little bit of extra money and you don't need to worry about the things that are actually costing more at the same time.
Let me ask you this question. Do you favour tax cuts, a party of tax cuts, or of budget, and from that point of view, budget cuts, or do you believe that government can use money to directly help people away from or outside of that tax cut arena?
I'm a big fan of government helping as many people as they can. A tax cut is always going to be disproportionate, and it doesn't matter which government gives it. If it's a right-wing government, the tax cut's going to go to people who earn more. If it's a left-leaning government, the tax cuts would tend to go to people who earn less. But they're still targeted and unevenly sort of distributed. I would much prefer that the government, with its ability to make things easier for everyone, gave everyone the same opportunities. You know, I'd prefer somebody who was earning $120,000 a year is getting the same free childcare as somebody who's earning, you know, $35,000-$40,000 a year. So that it's equitable input from the government to make sure that everybody has the same base level of being able to use services and see benefits from it.
Anything? What would be your if you were pushed? How would you? What things are the government doing that are good out of this budget?
There's a couple that I would say if you're really interested, like the breast cancer thing. I think is a really good thing.
Yeah.
And I've actually surprisingly been supportive of that since then. I thought that was actually a really solid thing that they were doing. I struggle to find much of anything else there that I am a big fan of. You know, if they funded those cancer meds, for example, you would not have heard a complaint from me about that. But I think the way that this government communicates, and that this might actually be down to their lack of experience in government, that is problematic. It doesn't always get across what they want to get across. It is far too easy to pick apart what it is that they're doing. They can certainly use some skills for that. And it doesn't help as well that you've got somebody like Christopher Luxon claiming to be the king of TikTok and making really cringy social media videos, while, you know, you've got people on the street complaining about how much it costs to send their kids to school.
Yes. Yes. And what are the bad points about the budget, do you think? Or what doesn't it address?
I think what it does really well is show you what the priorities are in this government. So what it doesn't address are things like inequitable outcomes in our education or our health sectors. What it doesn't address are things like the cause of problems that lead to crime. It just deals with what happens after people commit a crime.
Yeah.
I think it's very much it's about reactions instead of going on the offense and trying to find ways to fix the problems. It's all about how you tell people off for doing something that they shouldn't have and make sure they never do it again, which doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And then, of course, you've got the gangs, and the gang patches, and the freedom of them to move and associate. It's just politics, isn't it?
It is. Yep, absolutely. I mean, gang patches are a really fascinating one. You know, it's been deemed a breach of the, I think, the Human Rights Act to tell people that they can't wear gang patches because it's about freedom of expression. And the government has said, I don't care. And that's their choice, which means that they then have to live with the consequences of that further down the line. And we've seen in Australia where similar laws have been pushed back on because of that particular clause. But at the same time, how do I know the person on the street who's got a couple of facial tattoos is in a gang or isn't in a gang if I can't identify them in their patches?
Yeah.
We've already seen a couple of break-ins, for example, of pharmacies for pseudoephedrine. Since that's been brought back, how do we know if those are related to gang crimes or people going off and making drugs, or if that's just some local tweaker out there who's got really super excited because they can't be identified through things like gang patches that they're not wearing in public anymore?
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting example of let's make something sound good.
Well, it's a matter of, you know, I'm not pro-gang by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time, I can see the arguments for and against.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's a really interesting one. Like, gangs are not ideal. Definitely not. But the most popular Prime Minister we've ever had when it comes to gangs was Robert Muldoon.
Right.
Because he would go out and talk to me and say, what can I do to stop you guys doing this? Instead of demanding that they don't do something. So the gangs had a bit of respect for us. And it was things like build up work schemes so people can get out to work. Find ways to make sure that we are less reliant on drugs. Honestly, the most effective thing that any government could have done in the last 10 years to limit the power of gangs would have been to legalise marijuana.
Yes.
That suddenly cuts out a huge amount of their income, their influence and their reach.
But, that's right.
You know, didn't happen. So
didn't happen.
Can't do anything about it.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Paul. And I thank you for...
Well, thank you.
I thank you for being part of the program, and I wish you all the very best at Armageddon.
Thank you very much.
That was Paul Barlow, political commentator and broadcaster extraordinaire at Armageddon, actually, at the moment, which is lovely. All righty, that's me for another week. I'll be back next week, of course. You've been listening to Backchat with James King on Free FM. Catch you next week. Keep talking. They tell me it's healthy.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.